Hello and welcome to the Autosport Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas. Formula One's 2020 Bahrain Grand Prix took place today at the Sakhir Circuit. Lewis Hamilton beat Max Verstappen to the win, but the race was really overshadowed by a horrifying crash for Haas driver Romain Grosjean, who survived his car bursting into flames after being sent into the barriers on lap one following contact with AlphaTauri driver Daniel Kvyat. The race was red flagged immediately after the accident, and thankfully it soon emerged that Grosjean had been able to escape the inferno and was being treated by the FIA's medical crew, who played a vital part in his escape from the fire. Grosjean was taken to the track's medical centre and was then airlifted to hospital, from which he was assessed to have suffered no broken bones, but does have burns to his hands and ankles. It goes without saying, we wish him well in his recovery and express our sincere relief at seeing him survive the accident. After a delay of 1 hour and 20 minutes as the barriers were repaired, actually replaced with concrete blocks, the race restarted with another grid start where Hamilton was able to again easily lead away. Things quickly boiled down to a two-horse race between the Mercedes driver and Verstappen, with Hamilton appearing to have things under control. The second stint was the biggest moment of danger for Hamilton as he had to match Verstappen's pace on the hards while looking after his softer mediums. They both ended up on the hards after their second stops, after which Verstappen closed in despite his own stop being a slow one. But he never got within 3 seconds of the Mercedes driver up front, and Red Bull in fact opted to pit the Dutchman for a third time given he had a large gap in hand over Sergio Perez behind. Perez was in third after Valtteri Bottas had made a poor initial start and slipped backwards at turn one, which had appeared to spark a series of smaller incidents that ended later with Grosjean's crash, which is of course not to say that there was any blame in any of them. Perez had done a fine job to run clear of Alex Albon in the second Red Bull, and he looked set for a second successive podium until his engine let go with just 4 laps remaining. The race therefore finished under the safety car, with Hamilton taking his 11th win of the campaign, while Albon completed the podium. So, joining me to discuss all of that and more on Zoom tonight are Motorsport.com's F1 editor Jonathan Noble, Autosport's F1 reporter Luke Smith, and GP Racing's executive editor Stuart Codling. Now, Codders, I'm going to come to you first because you and I were in pretty constant communication throughout the early stages of that race as we were sort of trying to piece together what was going on. Once we knew that Romain Grosjean was all right, we were obviously trying to do that to make sure our race report on autosport.com and motorsport.com was as accurate as it could be. But yeah, I wanted to come to you first, just if you don't mind, do you think you could talk us through the first start and how that ended up with Grosjean's crash at the end of it?
I could almost look through a transcript of our WhatsApp messages, couldn't I? Because, it wasn't very pleasant work, actually, and not particularly nice to do it at the time, given that we began the process before we knew what had happened, actually, to Romain, and before we knew he was okay. We were starting to pick over some of the details leading up to the accident. And like you say, it's one of those shunts that is an accumulation of small events and people doing things that builds towards a conclusion. And it does start with Valtteri Bottas having a slow getaway. He seemed to get away when the lights went out. He got away perfectly well. But then in the second phase, acceleration, not so much. And he wasn't the only person. Ocon was slow away. He was passed by Norris and Gasly. Albon and Perez, and then Ricciardo got past Bottas. And that just meant that you sort of had this situation where in Bahrain, three cars can go through turn one abreast, but only really one or two can get through turn two abreast. So that there's that's a natural funnel point, that sort of vestibule between turn one and turn two. So you had basically people sorting things out with each other. Just looking at my notes, there's squeezes all the way down the field. And so I suppose you have Lewis getting a clean getaway, Verstappen going through as well. And then Albon sort of makes it stick and gets through. And you have Ricciardo and Albon sort of alongside each other and sorting it out between themselves. That causes Bottas to slightly check his pace maybe a little bit through turn two. And then further back, you have squeezes. You have Leclerc, Vettel and Stroll, who are also three abreast through turn one. Leclerc got a poor getaway and then sent it very deeply into turn one. So you have an awful lot of people who are trying to make up ground having got a poor start. So you have the situation where Bottas seems to be balked a little bit as Albon gets ahead of Ricciardo. Norris taps Gasly. Sainz has to get out of the throttle to avoid that squeeze at turn two with Norris having to check up ahead of him. Vettel, who's then arriving kind of three abreast with Stroll on his right, Leclerc on his right, has to check very hard to avoid running into the back of what's ahead of him. He jinks right, Stroll goes right. And that then creates a scenario where there's a lot of slow-moving traffic, and Grosjean arrives at that scene, sees all those cars slowing ahead. You have Raikkonen going off track on the left in an attempt to go around the sort of the slightly slower moving cars. And I think Grosjean naturally, in the heat of the moment, goes to the right, maybe sort of either forgetting or not observing that Kvyat, his sort of 5 o'clock almost, and Kvyat's only there because he's been in a squeeze with the Alfa Romeos, and he's been slowed down because he's had to pretty much go over the apex at turn one to avoid clonking into Magnussen, if my notes reflect this accurately. So all those circumstances kind of build into what we saw happen, a very, very fiery accident, and one that was very scary.
Indeed it was. Before we come on to talk about, you know, the really terrifying part, the car being on fire and Grosjean having to escape the inferno, Luke, I wonder if we could just come to you. What is the latest information we have at the time of recording about Grosjean's condition in hospital?
So Grosjean, as we'd have seen on the world feed, he was obviously transported from the, initially sat in the medical car, then taken into the ambulance and taken to the medical centre. And they were quick to report that he had some burns to his hands and his ankles. And then Haas reported that he was being taken to the Bahrain military hospital with suspected broken ribs. And they've then conducted all of the x-rays and all of the checks required at the hospital and found that he's got no broken bones, which is really good news. And the diagnosis they've come back with is that he's got burns to the back of both of his hands. So that obviously will require some treatment. He's going to remain in hospital overnight so they can complete that treatment and keep him under observation, basically, to make sure everything is okay. But Roman, he's in good spirits. He spoke to Günther Steiner. He's spoken to his family on the phone as well. And then he also put a video up on Instagram a couple of hours ago, which was really, really good to see. And he said, "I'm okay." And he was like, "Well, not completely okay." And then showed his hands, which are kind of in these white gloves to look after them. And but it seemed in very, very chipper and in very good spirits. And he said he hoped that he'd be able to reply to some of the messages and obviously the outpouring of support and love that he's got from the F1 community very, very soon. But yeah, it is. It was very, very nice, I think, at the end of this day that we were able to see such sort of a positive and happy video from him. And even if it's coming from a hospital bed, he's got a big smile on his face. So that was really, really pleasing to see.
Absolutely. It was immense relief, first of all, to see him in the medical car, to know that he was out, because I thought it was very interesting. I thought the F1 TV director deserved a lot of credit, certainly at the very beginning of what was going on in that long red flag period. I know there's a bit of bit of dispute from some of the drivers about the amount of replays that were eventually shown, but at the start, at least, they cut away. They didn't show anything until it was obviously clear that Grosjean was out of the car, and at least at that point was okay, which I thought was very commendable. But John, coming to you, can you just explain to us what happened with Grosjean in the barriers and in the fire, how he got out, and the vital role, as I said, that the FIA's safety crew, the medical car crew, played in getting him out?
So there's been endless replays. There's angles from the helicopter. There's a camera, which I think is one of the most amazing sequences, is from the other side of the track, at track level, looking across, and it looks like as the flames are going, and the medical crew turns up. It looks like a movie scene. It looks like something from a Hollywood blockbuster, as the fire gets up, and then the stuntman gets out of the flames and comes forward. You can't believe that this is real and this is Formula One, but that's how it was. But the impact, the second the car impacted the barriers, the car split in half, the fuel lines were split open, and that's why we got the huge fireball. It was 9 seconds was all it took between that fire starting and the medical car stopping on the scene. So very swift response there. It was 17 seconds before the first fire extinguisher got to the flames. It was a marshal on actually behind the barriers, got there first. And it was Dr. Ian Roberts who then arrived literally a second or 2 seconds later, with another marshal who fumbled for a little bit to pull the pin on the fire extinguisher, but he started attacking the flames. And just as he managed to push those flames back a little bit, it was just as Roman kind of popped up over the barriers, it was enough to give him his escape route. And that was 28, 29 seconds, so between the fire starting and Roman getting out. And you can see he was dazed. His visor was, Ian Roberts said, the visor had melted. He was all confused, but Ian was there. Ollie van der Merwe, the medical car driver, was there, and they kind of led him away. Just those images are just incredible. Just, I mean, Roman probably can't take it all in what's happened to him. If you look at the photos closely, it looks like his left boot has either been burnt off or fell off in the accident, because he's got one sock on and one boot on. The overalls are covered in fire extinguisher and singed from the flames. So just incredible scenes that I think we've not seen. I think we've got to go back to maybe Imola 89 for something similar, when Gerhard Berger had that big fiery crash in the early stages of the San Marino Grand Prix, to see something as terrible as this.
I thought it showed amazing presence of mind, and you kind of hope that if any of us were ever in such a crisis situation, we would have that presence of mind of Dr. Ian Roberts rushing towards the scene, but then seeing that the marshal was struggling with the fire extinguisher and just stopping to sort that out. You know, a lot of people would flap in similar circumstances, but he was just incredibly cool and sorted that out and showed the marshal how to work the fire extinguisher and made sure it was deployed before he kind of carried on with his job. It was remarkable.
It certainly was. It was really interesting to hear Ian Roberts and Ollie van der Merwe talking afterwards. They did, you know, the FIA brought them, they did all the TV stations, they did a group session with the journalists in the media centre, and Ollie van der Merwe saying, you know, actually, his first thought at that point, it just shows you that you know, the mental capacity these guys have. One of his first thoughts was, well, what happens if Ian gets incapacitated? Because he's gone straight almost into the fire. If the main doctor goes down, what happens then, sort of thing? But fortunately, everything worked out very much for the best. And really, a lot of people saying, including Grosjean himself, how well the Halo did an excellent job in saving his life. I mean, it doesn't bear thinking about what might have happened had it not been there. But still, question marks as well about what happened to the barrier. We know that motorsport is very, very dangerous. There's probably never going to be a completely foolproof solution, at least not one that we might be able to think of right now. But yeah, Coddis, maybe coming back to you, what did you make of how all the safety structures, the safety processes, how they all worked at that first corner crash?
I think it's very dangerous to speculate about whether barriers are working as they should, because it's an inexact science, and those barriers in that position are not necessarily designed to receive a racing car travelling at that sort of speed and at that sort of angle of impact. And I did actually interview a month or so back a chap who works for one of the main companies that supplies the FIA and certain circuits around the world with protective barriers. And it was a very interesting conversation where he said that as car performance has gone up, the solution that a lot of circuits and barrier manufacturers came up with was simply to sort of beef up the materials and beef up the mounting points with the aim of kind of resisting any impact. But what you actually want with an impact is for the forces to be dispersed, and so you don't actually necessarily want a hugely strong barrier that doesn't move, because that doesn't actually disperse the forces. You need the barrier to deform in a certain way. So I think it's a slightly inexact science, and maybe there will be some lessons from the way that barrier behaved in terms of future safety provisions. And it was certainly an unanticipated accident, and I rather hope that they will take a few lessons from it. But you know, we're dealing with huge energies when a racing car hits a supposedly immovable object. So I think what people have to realise is that just beefing up the barriers and making them stronger doesn't actually contribute to safety, because I think what was it? It was 160, 170 miles an hour he was going at the point of impact, I think.
137.
So 137. When a racing car hits an object at 137 miles an hour. That's an awful lot of kinetic energy that has to be, and energy doesn't disappear. It has to turn into some other form of energy. It moves along, it ripples. So that the barrier has to deform and transfer the that energy of impact. So maybe what we need to look at is a cleverer form of barrier design, but that is a lesson that I think we need to look at, and maybe the right authorities need to take stock over the winter and make a decision based on the evidence and not based on knee-jerk reactions to what people on the internet say should happen.
It's the same thing with car, racing cars as well. I mean, it looked shocking that the rear of the car was one side of the barrier and the survival cell was the other, and there's virtually nothing left of many bits of it. But actually, cars breaking apart in a controlled manner are what you want, because every time that car's breaking apart and things are breaking, that's energy being dissipated. All of those things happen in a set process. The crash structures at the side of the car are aimed to deform in a set way, which they did today. So every element of that crash, happened in the way that it was designed to do in some respects. The worst thing you can have is a car that's so solid that then hits a really, really solid crash barrier with a point of impact where then the only movable item within that racing car is the human body driving it. And then that's the thing that ends up getting broken. So every element of that crash was designed to protect just one thing. It didn't matter if all the rest of it fell apart to nothing. All there to protect one element, and that one element was Romain Grosjean.
Yeah, I was just saying to our producer before everyone joined in and we hit record that this is one of the worst accidents I've seen since Mike Rockefeller's shunt in the Audi at Le Mans when he was passing one of the GTE cars and the guy either failed to spot him or misjudged the distance, and he went into the barrier at a huge rate of knots, and there was practically nothing left of the car but the safety stall that Rockefeller was sitting in. And it's an accident you don't see much of, and one that sort of faded into history because it was dark at the time, so there's not that sort of video that people can share and look at and draw lessons from. But I remember at the time people saying, well, this is disgusting, how can Audi make a car that just falls to pieces when it hits a barrier? And that, of course, is to completely misunderstand the physics of the situation. The car has to disintegrate progressively and dissipate those energies so that it doesn't go through the human body that's sitting at the heart of it.
Absolutely, absolutely, Codders. Well, Luke, coming to you, I mean, as I said, they red flagged the race. I actually looked up at the clock. It was after 36 seconds had taken place. That's when the clock stopped. Brought the drivers into the pit lane, and there was a long delay, obviously, first of all, everyone understanding that Grosjean was okay, and then being taken away from the incident, and then the barrier itself being replaced. It was fairly quick, I would say, that not in terms of like anything was rushed, but just in terms of the process that obviously the race would carry on once those repairs had taken place. But what was the driver's reaction? How did they sort of cope with seeing what had gone on? Because obviously there were replays on the giant TV screen, I think that's above the pit buildings. And I think also I imagine through their TV screens in the garages that their cars were lined up next to. So yeah, how did they find the red flag period?
Yeah, as you say, there was a lot of replay shown. I think that's something that a lot of the drivers did struggle with. And they were all obviously instructed to return to the pit lane. And then quickly, when it became clear that there was going to be quite a lengthy wait, they were got out of their cars and went to sort of rest in their rooms or take a comfort break or anything like that. But they did show the replays a number of times. And for some of the drivers, that went too far. Daniel Ricciardo was very outspoken about it after the race. He said he called it disgusting. He said they were effing with our emotions, and he was really quite taken aback that they'd shown those replays so often for all the drivers to see. And it was all of the drivers did sort of share a sort of an unease about it. Valtteri Bottas, he said he watched it once to understand what had happened, but then afterwards was trying to avoid it and just didn't want to see it again. So it is always difficult. I think regardless of what the delay is caused by, when the drivers have got so in the zone for that race start, and obviously it's the highest pressure point of the whole race weekend, and then it's quickly red flagged and they've got like an hour of waiting and sitting around. It's very difficult for them to sort of like keep focused and keep in the right mindset, let alone when you throw in an accident that was so horrific and so shocking. That is a real sort of, that's really difficult for all of them to deal with. And Lewis Hamilton, he spoke after the race about sort of the importance of staying in the right mindset and how you've really got to stay focused. Toto Wolff, he said it takes huge courage from the drivers to get back in the car and sort of put everything out of their mind after seeing such an accident. But yeah, it was a lengthy wait. It was obviously all the barrier repairs had to be completed. As you say, I thought it was a very swift job indeed. I think the wait was about an hour or so, but full props to the team at the FIA and Bahrain International Circuit for getting that all completed. And but the drivers did really sort of have to sort of mull things over. And I think the fact that it was being shown so often, whether or not for the fans, for the general public, you could argue that it's good in terms of sort of being informative and showing you sort of like the full extent of what actually happened in that accident. For the drivers themselves, you've then got to get back in the cars, go back out there and race. That is the absolute last thing in the world they want to see. So I think it's, yeah, it's something that I imagine will be discussed and probably reviewed, at least between the drivers and FOM, in terms of that exposure, because I don't think it did any of them any good before they got back in the car.
Well, let's move on to sort of a one last bit when we talk about this particular part of the race and what happened. John, how did the Haas team itself react? What was Günther Steiner saying? And obviously, it is very early to think about this, to consider this, but nevertheless, it's a question that's well worth asking. There's another race next weekend. What might happen with Grosjean Racing, or might they have to bring in a replacement?
Yeah, I think Günther, probably bigger sense of relief than anything else. I mean, it must be horrendous as any team member to see this happen to your driver. But I think it was quite swift. I think the first WhatsApp message we got from Haas was, you know, within seconds of the accident aftermath happening, when we got a message saying that they'd been informed that he was okay and was in the medical car. So I think a sense of relief that there was quite a quick response on that. I think Günther said this evening that a bit too early to ponder replacement driver. I think the big issue would be whether Roman's hand injuries are enough to, you know, keep him out of a car for next week. We know how kind of tough racing drivers are, how quick they can battle back. Some people have suggested that, you know, this could be it. This could be enough for him to decide, that's it, I'm done with Formula One. But I think racing drivers are different breeds sometimes, that accidents are part and parcel of the job. And it's like when you fall off a bicycle or fall off a horse, they often say that the best thing to do is jump straight back on and get out there again. So I'd be quite surprised if he decides that that's it, I'm not going to be a racing driver anymore after today. And in terms of replacements, you know, whether they go for a young rookie, someone like Pietro Fittipaldi, who's had a bit of experience, they could go down that route if he's got the necessary super license. Or they could, is super sub Nico Hülkenberg sniffing around? But they've only got a few days to sort this out. But I think it's something they'll wait to see how Roman develops over the next 24, 48 hours. And then I think they'll make the call.
Yeah, I think a lot of it will depend on Roman's mindset. And I think that if he did turn around to the team and say, look, I'm done, I don't want to do it anymore, they would fully respect that obviously. And it would, I don't think anyone would begrudge him of that. But as you say, racing drivers are quite a unique breed, and they do tend to want to sort of be back in the car and to sort of tackle their fears as much as they can. And I think Roman, he's always been someone who's very, I think, mindful of the sort of mental aspects of F1. And he spoke a couple of weeks back, actually, as a feature editor for GP Racing, talking about sort of the mental side of F1 and how he Collins enjoyed that plug and how he's been working with a mind coach ever since his accident at Spa in 2012. And he continues to do that to this day, to work with someone who sort of like talks about his mental state. And he said it's helped him become not only a better driver, but a better husband, a better father. And I think that of all the drivers, in terms of dealing with such a, I guess, a mental setback and quite a traumatic episode, like undoubtedly for whoever's involved, I think Roman is someone who can really, I think he can deal with that and tackle with that. So I think that hopefully bodes well, and that hopefully he's hands are healed enough that he is able to get back in the car and have his sort of final two race swan song, at least from Haas, probably from Formula One altogether. As John said, in terms of replacements, I think it's hard to say. Gunther, he spoke this evening and said, "Look, I don't really want to talk about it because the focus is I'll see Roman tomorrow in the hospital and then we'll go from there." But he said there's always backup plans. I don't believe either Fittipaldi or Louis Delatraz, the other Haas reserve, have the necessary super license points. That would maybe open the door for Nico Hülkenberg. Would Mick Schumacher, who already has a super license, would Haas dare go a little bit earlier than anticipated? I don't know. But it's all hypothetical stuff. But I think the main thing is that I think Roman, we hope that we'll see him back in the car next weekend, mentally and physically fit to race.
Indeed, and I think you touched on an interesting point there, Luke, about the fact that we suspect this probably will be Romain Grosjean's last two races in Formula One, considering he was already out of the Haas team and probably out of the championship as well at the end of the season. So perhaps that will be a factor in whether he comes back or not. But whatever happens, we hope that the right decision is taken and that it's all done in his best interest and whatever he's happy with as well. But let's move on to talking about the rest of the race, which did take place. I thought it was very, very interesting to hear Max Verstappen speaking afterwards, clearly not very impressed at Red Bull's strategy, particularly when it came to the first round of pit stops where Mercedes pitted first and Verstappen and Perez came in a lap later. Now, what's interesting is the undercut was actually quite powerful here, which I think we saw a lot later on when Red Bull did seem to take the initiative a little bit more. And even after Verstappen's really, really slow second stop, he still amazingly got the gap that was about 5 seconds before he came in to down to just over three, even though he'd been stationary for three seconds longer than he needed to be. So it really did show the power of the undercut. But he wasn't very happy with Red Bull in the press conference. So, Luke, coming to you because I know you went to Christian Horner's media session, what was the team's response about why they'd chosen the route that they did on strategy?
Christian Horner explained, he said that if they'd have pitted him earlier as Max would have wanted, that he'd have come out in traffic and that would have compromised them even more. So he said they were kind of sort of forced to pit when they did, basically. And he said that the fact there were these eight laps at the beginning that were obviously under the safety car and essentially lost because of not only the first lap incident, but then the subsequent role for Lance Stroll and the safety car that followed when the race did eventually resume, that kind of eight laps out of the race, and that meant that a sort of like optimal three-stop strategy, which it sounded like from what Horner was saying that Red Bull were leaning towards, that kind of went out the window and it pushed it more towards a two-stop. And obviously Red Bull did go for the three stops in the end, really to sort of push home for that fastest lap point. But he said that it would have been that Max would have come out into traffic, he'd have then had to pass a couple of cars, and then that would have sort of lost the opportunity to undercut. So it kind of, what was the point of doing it? But as you say, Max less than impressed about it, but Horner said that it's something that they'll obviously review and they talked about with Max, but he was quite comfortable with the decisions that Red Bull took on that front.
Yeah, John, what did you make of Verstappen's reaction? Because, generally he hasn't seemed too bothered to be finishing second this season, because he just knows how good Mercedes is. And it's better than finishing third behind the two of them. But he clearly wasn't very happy with what Red Bull had done. Do you think that was an indication that he thought he really could win this race going in?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between finishing second 30 seconds kind of down the road and the way you've had no chance of battling the race leader and finishing second. I know the gap at the end was, it was falsely small because of the safety car and then falsely big because he'd had the pit stop, but it would have been 5-6 seconds ultimately if the race had played out. But I think it was a small enough gap for Max to have felt today that there was a chance to perhaps push the Mercedes, maybe corner them a little bit on strategy. Max had the benefit of a new hard tyre in the race, which Mercedes didn't have. So they had some slightly different options to Mercedes going into the race. So, and it was clear there was a radio message early on about, we're gonna send it today and we're going to kind of do some stuff we aren't normally going to do. So I think what they felt, they weren't going to potentially beat Mercedes on pure pace on the being on the same tyre doing the same thing. They needed to do something different, and the way to do something different was to be aggressive and push on a bit. And also wonder if there were some comments from Max after Alex Albon, who finished on the podium today, but Max said, well, nothing special because he was ultimately probably 30 seconds behind me. But again, it's that problem Red Bull has if it needs a rear gunner for Max, because by not having the second Red Bull car that's shadowing Max even 5 seconds back or 10 seconds back, what that does is it leaves the door open for Mercedes to run their own strategy. It can't be the disrupting force that they need to be. So I do wonder if Max's comments of Alex were fueled by him not having those strategic options that would have been there if Alex had been there protecting him.
Yeah, sometimes you feel that Red Bull know that they have a power to panic Mercedes into making a pit stop. Very often they'll bring Max in and Mercedes will react. And this was a race where that didn't happen. And so I wonder if on the pit wall they thought, oh, right, well, we fired a shot and they haven't fired back. They must have something in the pocket. And that sort of slightly took the impetus out of them. And it was kind of only at the end when Lewis said, you know, oh, well, that was really difficult. I was struggling. I was sliding the tyres a lot. They sort of revised their opinion from the, we got the most we could out of the car today to, oh, well, actually, maybe we've missed a trick.
Indeed, it was interesting. I asked both Verstappen and Hamilton about their sort of approaches to those tyres, because we know how key that is in Formula One. You either take the approach that Verstappen did, which was give it everything, even though he knew that he'd be sacrificing tyre life at the end of the stints, or do what Hamilton did, which was basically protect his tyres during the early stages. And John, as you said, with the extra set of hards that Verstappen had, Hamilton had to be really careful on the medium tyres, because if he pushed too hard too early on, he really was going to end up in trouble. But yeah, Cotter's maybe coming back to you. What did you make of what Hamilton did there? Because it just looked, as I said, it looked like he had everything under control, but there was elements of danger that he just again used his tyre management superiority to be able to come away ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Very often in races where it kind of looks like he's making imperious progress, that his radio messages have a sort of a certain sense of urgency to them, as if it's kind of like the whole swan thing where, you know, you see the top half gliding across the water, you don't see the feet paddling furiously underneath. Whereas this was a race where you didn't actually see any cracks in the facade for quite a long time. It was only at the end where he was starting to question the wisdom of the team not bringing him in for a final pit stop when the safety car pitted. And I got the impression at that point that they were, if not snookered, they were probably thinking, well, actually, maybe we should have done, but now that time has passed. Because they said, well, we're marginal. Let me just have a look at my notes now. Did they say marginal or critical? I've got pages of notes here.
It's marginal. Marginal.
It's marginal. They said, basically, when Mercedes says something is marginal, that's basically the red lights flashing and, oh, wow, we're in trouble. So that to me said that if the safety car period had been a couple of laps earlier, then maybe they would have been in trouble for the final thing. So in the final analysis, you have to say that Lewis was quite fortunate to be able to finish behind the safety car, because had Perez's engine blown a couple of laps earlier, things might have panned out a little differently.
Indeed, indeed. Well, Luke, coming to you, let's talk about Valtteri Bottas. As Scott has already described what happened at the very start of the race, but He was sort of unlucky again, as he always seems to be, certainly this season, by picking up a puncture during the first safety car. And then actually, in actual fact, I think he had a second puncture during the final safety car right at the very end. But that first puncture really, really did for his race, dropped him down to sort of 16th at the restart. And then, sorry, the second restart, the safety car restart. And then he had to recover from there. But he didn't seem initially to be making much progress. So I asked you to we could get an explanation of that from Bottas himself during his media session. So what was his explanation for why he was sort of seemingly stuck at one point behind an Alfa Romeo and then a Williams, which are two cars really the Mercedes should be breezing past with ease, even if it isn't very good? You know, maybe it's not the best car at following others, but you'd certainly expect him to get by those two. So yeah, what was going on there?
It was quite surprising, wasn't it? There was even a point when he was stuck behind George Russell. And I was sort of thinking, oh, this will get the fire going for anyone wanting to see Russell in a Mercedes in the future. But no, I asked Bottas about it after the race, and he said basically they were thinking at that point that they could maybe make a one-stop strategy work. So really save the tyres, not work them too hard early on. But it quickly became clear that he was losing so much time stuck behind those cars that it wasn't really possible to make that strategy work. So in the end, had to sort of push on and just deal with the tyre management and having to make the additional pit stops. But another very unlucky race for Bottas. Like he's been pretty rotten on luck this season. I know he does get a lot of criticism, but it has felt like all of the issues that Mercedes have faced have been on his car and not on Lewis Hamilton's. And Toto Wolff said after the race that if Bottas wasn't the sort of strong mental character he is, that driver might be questioning, why always me? Why is it never the other car? Is there something going on there? But he said he knows Valtteri is much too strong to ever sort of have such thoughts or anything like that. And yeah, Valtteri was quite sort of just accepting of it after the race as well. He joked that there's been a black cat near his place in Monaco that he's been feeding, and he's like, there'll be no more food for that black cat, which is probably for the best. But Connors is outraged at that, the idea of not feeding cats.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to establish, Connors, it wasn't you that asked him the question about the black cats in the press conference, was it?
It wasn't me, no, because I feed a white and black cat and a black and white cat in our household. But in my notes, I wrote Bottas : naked gun, because his fortunes in the race today reminded me of older listeners may appreciate this. In the opening reel of the film Naked Gun, you see O.J. Simpson's character basically get shot, and then he sort of leans back, puts his hand back to sort of stop himself falling, and burns his hand on a stove, and he's basically bouncing around this room injuring himself, having been shot, before he finally falls over the side of this boat in this hilarious comic sequence. But the Valtteri Bottas's chain of misfortunes just put me in mind of that.
That's a good brand name, isn't it? Valtteri Bottas's chain of misfortune.
Yes.
It also very accurately sums up his 2020 season, I think. Very good there. Cotters, you'll be interested to know that I got a Blackadder reference into last night's podcast that very nearly didn't get published because a certain someone, me, made a bit of a catastrophic error when it came to sending the audio file. But fortunately, we got available in that. And don't worry, I will fully reveal what that error was in our season review podcast when I shall reveal all the other ridiculous and hilarious errors I've made this season, including that big one.
Oh, are we going to have a blooper reel?
Yeah, oh yeah, they're good. I mean, you know a few of them from testing and the meal in Melbourne. Anyway, we'll save it for that podcast. We won't let the listeners know my complete and utter stupidity at this stage. Anyway, but John, let's go on to talk about Alex Albon and Sergio Perez as well, because obviously a lot of interest in them even coming into this race because of the speculation that maybe Perez is going to go to Red Bull. He's called a press conference on Monday. What's that going to be about? Albon does get another podium. He's second in Formula One, but Verstappen, as you say, sort of alluding to the fact that, you know, he was really far behind him. But first of all, what a good drive from Sergio Perez, and so unfortunate to have it undone in the way it was.
Yeah, Perez is just, you know, hit his peak form, really. It should have been two podiums from two races, which would have been incredible. He's pretty much single-handedly...
Possibly 3-3. I'll just jump in there, because if you think about Imola as well, where the, you know, pitting him under the safety car really cost him against Ricciardo. But anyway, sorry to interrupt, John.
But yeah, he's single-handedly kind of hauling Racing Point to that third place battle in the Constructors' Championship. I think Lance Stroll scored 2 points since the Italian Grand Prix, which is, you know, incredible, really, for him. But yeah, Sergio's on fire. He knows that it's Red Bull or nothing for him next season. All he can do is keep doing exactly what he's doing at the moment. Keep firing away, keep driving like he's driving right now. You know, terrible, terrible luck. But if anyone's expecting him to make an announcement on Monday about his future, I think you'll be disappointed. From what I understand, it's not a press conference to announce anything as such. It's just that he normally has a bit of a catch-up meeting, briefing with Mexican journalists or Spanish-speaking media. Which has been delayed because obviously he caught COVID, was out for two races, and quite compressed calendar. It just so happens that they'll do it Monday here in Bahrain because it fits in, because everyone's hanging around in the Middle East for 3 weeks. So I don't think there'll be any set announcement on that front. And as far as Alex goes, you know, on paper you'd say qualifying fourth, finishing third was a good weekend for him, but I don't think it was as strong as he needs to be doing, really. It was... Red Bull's talked about, you know, needing a driver who can qualify within 0.3 of Max. Alex was 0.6 back in qualifying. And in the race, as Max rightly pointed out, the gap was still big. Alex wasn't in the position to be that disruptive force that they need to be battling with the Mercedes drivers. He would have finished fourth if Perez hadn't had that failure at the end. So I don't think it was, definitely wasn't enough for Alex to completely stake his claim to that Red Bull seat next year. I still think he needs to do more, needs to do something much, much better in the final two races.
Yeah, I was listening to the commentary of a certain channel where the lead commentator suggested that this podium was really Alex Albon staking his claim over Sergio Perez for the Red Bull seat. And quite frankly, you know, I've heard a lot of people say some very stupid things this year, but quite frankly, that's in contention for a podium of stupid things I've heard said recently, because let's face it, inheriting a podium position doesn't really stake any claim to anything. Good for him, but at the end of the day, he inherited a position because someone's engine blew up, or they had an ERS failure. So, quite frankly,
if I may put up a slight defence for Alex Albon, because no, it wasn't the kind of display that you really do need from your second driver at Red Bull, and no, he wasn't the thorn in Mercedes' side that he said he wanted to be after qualifying. But I felt it was a step forward in what we've seen recently. And I don't know if that's just more about his recent form or what, but I thought it was a very fuss-free, trouble-free display. Didn't make any big mistakes. Made the overtakes he needed to make. Probably should have been a bit closer to Perez. Definitely should have been a bit closer to Perez, given the capabilities of that Red Bull car. And yeah, the gap to Verstappen was very, very big. But I think there were some good points you could pick out of that. And I think there were a few races where there really weren't any good points at all. Like, it was really, really quite poor. But I think there are quite a few positives he can take away. Christian Horner, he said after the race that Red Bull won't be making any decision on its driver lineup being confirmed until after the end of the season. So Alex has got two more races to, as John says, sort of put in that display that really does stake a claim for that seat and say, look, this is mine. But I think today felt like a step in the right direction. Alex, I don't know how he's going to fare in your driver ratings, but I wouldn't imagine it's too disgraceful.
The driver ratings,
it's a tough one, this one, because as you say, Luke, there have been much, much worse races for Albon this season. But I think the really damning thing in it is that he was comprehensively beaten by a slower car in Sergio Perez before the engine issue. And that's like, yeah, okay, you know, yeah, he was quite far away from Verstappen, but he was behind Perez. And I think that's really going to cost him. Also, there was the fairly, you know, the massive crash in FP2. Okay, didn't have an effect on the rest of the weekend, but that was another down note. But anyway,
of course.
I do take
fatally wounded him
potentially, but I do take your point in that yes, he's done good things this weekend, but still some negative stuff when he needs to be all excellent. Let's face it. Well, let's come on to a team that did have a very excellent result, and that's McLaren. Cotters, excellent points in the fight for P3, and it was amazing seeing. It's a bit like Turkey, how that fight is just swinging around the momentum between the teams, even in races. At the start in Turkey, obviously Racing Point up front, then Renault looked like they were going to have a great race, and it all went wrong at the first corner. And here, Renault sort of qualifying really well, then Perez is in amongst it at the first corner. He looks like he's going to be on the podium. Then his car blows up and McLaren are suddenly the lead Class B runners in fourth and fifth. And also, hats off to Carlos Sainz Jr., because I did not think anybody could make those soft tyres work. And he really did. He really used them for a very, very long time and did excellently well. So yeah, how did McLaren come out on top of the Class B battle?
Carlos, as the vernacular goes, smoked the cigar down to the stub with those soft tyres, didn't he? He really, really did make them last for, what, more than 20 laps? I'm going to have to go through my notes again. But yeah, end of lap 21, he pitted to put on the medium. So remarkable amount of life he squeezed out of the softs, which looked to be a ridiculous and outre strategy. I suppose, to be fair, we have to say that neither of the Renaults made brilliant starts. Certainly at the first start, and then at the restart, not brilliant. And then they ended up fighting each other on track. There was the general impression that the team had to step in and separate them almost and impose team orders to swap the order around, because Ricciardo was lobbying to be allowed past Ocon. Ocon seemed to be making a little bit of heavy weather on one set of tyres, but even then, after pitting to change them, didn't really seem to be able to make any more headway. And yeah, this is one of those races where some people just seem to have all the bad luck. McLaren, it seemed to fall their way a little bit. Norris didn't do, you know, he could quite easily have been eliminated in that little knock with Gasly at the beginning. Didn't lose too many positions. And Sainz, you know, we saw him have a slow pit stop as well and end up behind Leclerc and screaming down the team radio saying that, you know, this is terrible. He then makes very short work of Leclerc, Leclerc pits out the way anyway, as if he was barely there, just disappearing into the mist. So, yeah, a very, very, very good race always round for them, from the strategists through to the drivers actually making it work. And I kind of, to me, it feels like a team that's rediscovering its confidence. I interviewed Andreas Seidel for a forthcoming GP Racing magazine feature the other week, and I said to him, it does feel that you guys are able to be a little bit more racy at the moment. You have the confidence to back yourselves and maybe to do strategies that are a little bit more risky, and that you have faith in the driver's ability to execute that. And more often than not, it comes out right. And that's what happened today.
Indeed, Curtis, I hope you noticed that both Luke and I smiled when you used the phrase heavy weather. Because obviously we are both imagining your Patrick Head impression.
Patrick Head impersonation.
Always a favourite on the Autosport podcast. Well, guys, I think we better leave it there. It is getting rather late in Bahrain. It's 1:30 in the morning, and I still have to do the Autosport magazine and Autosport Plus race report, plus driver ratings, plus maybe a column as well. So I'm going to call time, as it were, for a few things we didn't get to cover, but such is life when it's a very action-packed, dramatic, and thankfully not tragic race. So anyway, thank you very much to the three of you for coming on the podcast tonight, and thank you to everybody listening along. Now, just before we go, we'd like to remind you that the latest issue of Autosport magazine came out on Thursday and is available on the supermarket shelves and in newsagents, as well as on the doormats of subscribers. There'll be a new issue of the magazine for you to pick up every Thursday, packed full of news, analysis, and the usual stunning photography. And of course, if you want unlimited access to Autosport from the comfort of your home, visit autosport.com/plus to find out how to subscribe to our digital package. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Autosport podcast.